Welcome to Bonafide HPP, a podcast designed to educate and support the families and caregivers of those affected by hypophosphatasia. As a mother and caregiver, host Deborah Fowler has discussions about this rare genetic bone disease with people from around the world. Join Deborah now as she speaks with this week's guest.
Hello, everybody, and happy holidays. Welcome to this special edition of Bonafide HPP, and I'm thrilled to have as our guest today Dr. Catherine Dehier from Vanderbilt, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the clinical trial, Alexion 1850, and we're super excited to have you here today. Welcome, Dr. Dehier.
Deb, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm thrilled to be here and honored to collaborate on any project with Softbone. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, it's such an exciting time in the world of HPP, just with so many different compounds in development, and especially this next, what I've been calling this next generation of aspartate alpha or Strensiq. And, you know, I wanted to just start off with some basic questions, because I realize that not everybody may understand what a clinical trial is. So why don't we start off just with, explaining what a clinical trial is to some patients and families that may have never heard that term before.
I think that's really a very fabulous way to start, because there's so much work that goes into developing a new treatment for patients even before you get to the clinical trial spot. So this is a perfect way to start. But what a clinical trial is, it's a research study conducted with human participants. And it's really to look at not just the effectiveness of a new medical intervention, so that can be a drug or a device or a procedure, but really most importantly, the safety. And so it takes a lot of work getting up to that start. So usually, say for example, a new drug is being developed, there's a lot of thought in understanding the disease. There's what we call preclinical work, where the drug or the molecule is tested in animals. And so there's a long process of making sure that this is safe before it ever reaches a person. So that's the number one important thing.
So it's not like you're just, people always say being tested like guinea pigs. There's a lot that goes into it before it ever is, brought to humans. Absolutely. Into the picture.
Absolutely. And for us to consider a study to be a clinical trial, it's heavily regulated. So there's a lot of oversight and rules and regulations that are meant to protect patients, so protect patients' rights and safety and as best as we can, do no harm. So that's number one. And then there's a whole progression of different types of studies that are in a clinical trial. So say we've made it past the preclinical and we've shown that it's safe and potentially effective in animals. So that doesn't always translate exactly to people. So the very first step is what we call a phase one. And a phase one, we also call it first in human. And so that's when we take a very small group of people, and sometimes it's not even people with the disease. Sometimes it's just completely healthy controls. And that phase one is to look at very early safety. So usually there's just maybe one or, a short period of time where the new drug is going to be tested. And it's really not only to ensure safety, but to help us to make sure we're going in the right direction with how we dose it. So there's a lot of thought in that very initial phase one in dosing. And so once you've shown that at least in the very beginning, it's safe and we can help to understand better what dose is appropriate in humans, that's when you go to the larger study. So phase two is a little bit bigger, looking again more at safety and then very early signs of effectiveness. And then phase three is the big study. So that's the study where we're really taking a deep dive. Again, safety is always first, and looking at potential side effects, and then also whatever you've decided are your important things that you're going to measure in the study, looking at effectiveness. So that's what a clinical trial is. And I think it's really important to have a good, healthy appreciation of what you're getting yourself into if you're if you're going to participate in a study, because there is always risk. There's always that risk of unknown. There's the risk of getting placebo if you're really hoping that you might get on the drug. And we really can't anticipate every single potential side effect that may come up. So there's that risk of, you know, the drug might make you feel uncomfortable or have an unexpected side effect. But really, when I think about probably the hardest thing for patients being in a clinical trial, there's lots of travel. So there's travel away, you're spending time away from your family, you may be missing work, you may be missing school or band practice. And so that, you know, we kind of want to make sure that you're using your time effectively there. But what I think is the greatest upside for patients participating in clinical trials is it's an opportunity to give the universe a gift of science. So you really are an incredibly important part of that process for getting a new treatment approved for people that don't have access, or, you know, for a disease that might not have any treatment at all. And so to be a part of that process to move science forward, I think is just a really incredible gift and an opportunity for patients.
Yeah,
That's what a clinical trial is.
That's great. No, that's so helpful. And, you know, I think a lot of times we hear about, you know, phase 1, and, you know, immediately when people hear anything, you know, a lot of times these companies are going to medical meetings and they're presenting their data, and I'll get calls from people saying, oh, I saw that press release on that drug. You know, it's phase 1. Is that going to be approved next year? Because I'm thinking about going on Strensiq and there's other treatments. And, you know, I try to explain that it's, you know, it takes time, and, you know, it's important that we take the time that's needed to test the safety and efficacy of these compounds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would say the average time from the very beginning of a phase 3 to go all the way through FDA approval and then having the drug available prime time for patients is about 7 years, which sounds like an eternity. And it is, it's kind of a long period of time. So that's a great thing to keep in the back of your mind, is this is a slow process.
It's a balance. And you think about how, you know, we were so, you know, the scientists and the medical community worked so hard to get the COVID vaccine up and running. And, you know, we know we can move faster, but it's that delicate balance between taking the time that we need to make sure that it's safe and effective with the time that, you know, patients are waiting. And we've got to figure out how to do it in an efficient and effective way. So let's talk about this trial. So I know that it's a little bit unique, and I think it's been a little confusing for some because there are several arms to this trial and different patient populations associated with each. So can you tell us a little bit about each of the arms and the goals for them respectively?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, there are 3 different studies, all with the same molecule. And, you know, to kind of put it into context about why it's been broken up into different groups is that this is a situation where for the most severe patients with hypophosphatasia, where aspartate alpha is truly life-saving, you want to not disrupt those patients from having access to that life-saving drug. So for somebody who is super severe and there is already an FDA-approved drug, it is not ethical to expect that those babies would be taken off of that life-saving drug. So these particular studies don't include the infantile form, and that's the right thing to do. That's the ethically moral thing to do. So when we break it into the 3 different groups, there are 2 studies that are geared for pediatric patients. ages 2 years to 12 years old. And so we have patients, we have children that are already on asphatase alpha. And so there is one part of the study that are one arm or group where the company is enrolling patients ages 2 to 12 that have already been on aspartate alpha for at least 6 months, and then comparing the new drug to aspartate alpha. And so in order for these kiddos to get in the study, they still have to be young enough and have open growth plates for us to be able to see if there's any difference in how patients are doing on the current FDA approved drug versus the new drug. So that's really important to keep in mind that, you know, these kiddos still have to be young. They have to be early in their developmental stage, and they have to have open growth plates. And the reason being is that we're looking at x-rays or radiographs. And so we're evaluating the radiographs compared to aspartate alpha and the new drug. So the biggest point of this study is that, you know, you hope that the results are going to be at least as good as what's already approved. But it's measuring the tolerability and the side effect profile. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really important. So yes, we know aspartate alpha can be life-saving in the most severe form. But the treatment's really hard. It's hard on everybody, but especially kids that have to get larger volumes injected either 3 days a week or 6 days a week. That can be associated with injection site reactions, lipohypertrophy, lipodystrophy. That's when the skin can get kind of saggy, where we're continuing to do those injections. And that's really, really hard on children. It's hard on adults too, but it's really, really hard on children. And so this study is what we call the switch study, is really, you know, the goal is to see if there's any meaningful difference between those side effects with what's already approved and with the new drug. So that's what we call the switch study.
Okay.
The other pediatric study is the treatment naive study. And so that means that they're looking for children ages 2 to 12 that have never been on aspartate alpha. And so this is a way to compare the new drug to a placebo. And so similar to this, to the switch study, they have to have x-rays. They have to be at an early developmental stage. And the x-rays have to show that there is some degree of rickets, and that what rickets is under mineralization of the growth plate. And so that can lead to things like short stature and bowing deformities, in addition to pain and all of those other things. And so when those kiddos get enrolled into that study, they have a chance of getting either 6 months of a placebo or 6 months of the new drug. And so what I think is really, really important for parents, families that are enrolling their children is to go in with a healthy appreciation that there may be 6 months of a placebo. So that's something that to think about carefully. The good news is that after 6 months, then the study goes to what's called open label. And what that means is that everybody gets the real thing. And so
if you're in it, you if you're worried about getting the placebo, you'll eventually have the drug.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so, you know, this is for children never treated. So it's either going to be brand new diagnosis, or oftentimes kids aren't treated because there's no access to the drug. So it might not be covered by insurance. There may be no insurance. They may, you know, for whatever reason, not qualify for any patient assistance. So it may be a good opportunity for children otherwise who couldn't have gotten on the drug anyway. But at 6 months, everyone gets the real thing. And so what that study is looking for, you know, what we call the primary outcome, is improvement in rickets on x-rays. So that's really the big difference between the pediatric naive study, is that we're looking for meaningful changes of effectiveness on x-ray, where for the switch study and for children, we're really looking at tolerability of the drug. So what's the difference in the side effect profile?
Okay.
So those are the two studies, the two pediatric studies. And then the third study is in an adolescent and an adult study. So that study actually includes children as well. So there's a certain amount of children ages 12 to 18, and then everybody else is 18 and up. And this is a double-blind, placebo-controlled study. So similar to what we were talking about with the treatment naive, there is a chance of being in the placebo group for the first 6 months, but then also similar, open label happens at that period of time. So everybody gets the real thing at 6 months. Now, thinking about what is your meaningful change of improvement for adults, it's a little bit trickier because growth plates are closed. So we can't evaluate for rickets on x-rays. Really the biggest thing that we consider success or improvement for treatment of hypophosphatasia in adults is that the mobility gets better. And the way that we're gonna, that this is gonna be looked at is with the 6-minute walk test. And so that's the primary outcome, is improvements in the 6-minute walk test. And so in terms of enrollment, what we can't do is enroll patients that don't have any impairment or deficits in mobility, because if we enrolled patients that all had a normal 6-minute walk test, then we would not be able to measure any meaningful change. So for patients with a disability in terms of walking mobility, that's really the most important thing for getting into that study. Okay. So that's the primary outcome, improvement in the 6-minute walk test. And then other outcomes that we're looking at are mostly functional measures, quality of life. And then for our ages 12 to 18, if they had any evidence of rickets on radiographs, looking at improvement in that.
It's so exciting. And I know we've talked about this, to have, you know, something for the adult patients. Cause I think that while there's many adults who've been able to access Strensiq, there is that subset of people who either weren't able to to get any kind of prove their case that they had a pediatric diagnosis, or they just didn't have the bone manifestations that you're talking about. So I'm just thrilled that they may have a potential treatment option in the future.
Yes. Oh, thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a really important point when we think about what patients have access to treatment. And if you don't have any manifestations prior to the age of 18, then that's not an FDA approved indication for asphatase alpha. So, and I think what's interesting, what we've really learned a lot over the last decade of just trying to understand what is hypophosphatasia, it's a really complicated disease, is that some patients can have pain and weakness and, you know, functional impairments, but their x-rays look normal, or they've never had a fracture. Yeah. So this is really designed to address those issues and hopefully serve those patients better.
That's great. For those who are on Strensiq now, we had some questions from patients about, will I be able to, you know, potentially access this new drug in the future if I'm on Strensiq now? Or, you know, even questions around, will Strensiq be discontinued, you know, after potentially 1850 is approved? What is your message to those patients about kind of what the future holds?
Right. That's a great question. And, you know, if we can go back to what we talked about at the beginning, is just the timeline as far as getting a new drug through clinical trials approved by FDA and then on insurance formularies is a marathon. It is not a sprint. So it's going to take a long time to get there. And then it really all boils down to, with the new drug, how safe is it? How effective is it? And how cost effective is it? And so when you are able to appreciate, is it more effective? Is it more safe? Does it cost society less? Then many payers, Medicare, insurance companies, they will review that and then they will make their decision about what is better for them as a company to cover. And so that will really drive production of what we call the first generation of the drug. If it's more expensive and less effective, then I would hypothesize that they're probably not going to make much more of it. But say it's, you know, who knows if it's the same or, you know, there are a lot of different factors that go into whether or not a company is going to continue with the original product or not. But I think we have a long way to go. Now, as far as having been on Asfotase Alfa, would that mean that your insurance company would not cover being on a newer version? That's not something that I would really worry about, especially at this point. The reason that the clinical trial does not want to enroll these adult patients who have already been on Strensiq is just really a class effect of studying an enzyme replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. And that if you've been on an enzyme replacement therapy, and this is for different diseases, different classes of enzyme replacement therapy, there is the theoretical chance that your body will make antibodies to it. And so could that potentially affect how effective the drug is? And so when you're designing a trial, you want to study it in the most clean, honest way possible, without biasing it towards patients' previous exposures and that, and could that potentially affect the effectiveness of the drug? And so that's really the thought process as to why patients who have been on Asfotase Alfa can't get into a clinical trial right now. But that shouldn't, in my mind, at least I can't think of any reason why the FDA or an insurance company wouldn't put roadblocks up to let patients be on a more effective drug, especially if it's more cost efficient.
Yeah. You know, you were just said something that triggered a question for me around, you know, people are potentially building up antibodies. And one of the questions that I had was, you know, really, how is this trial drug 1850 different from Strensiq? Can you speak to that at all?
Oh, for sure. I can speak about it in very general terms, of course. But, you know, the newer version of this drug is really meant to address the dissatisfiers with the current drug that's on the market, which is mostly the burden of injection. So injecting a large volume, injecting frequently, and then injection site reactions. And so, you know, to address those dissatisfiers with the treatment, what you would want to do is you would want to improve the effectiveness or the, you know, the enzyme activity, you want to improve whatever the function of that enzyme is to make it more efficient. So you need less of it. And then also, you know, potentially to make it last longer. So rather than having multiple injections daily, and I think for people that don't have hypophosphatasia, they don't understand that oftentimes when you inject, you're not injecting just one spot on each day. It can be multiple sites, you know, so it's And so, you know, really, I think that, you know, the primary objective is a more effective drug at a lower dose to overcome a lot of these,
some of those barriers,
you know, quality of life and dissatisfiers for patients.
Well, and hopefully that will help with, you know, some of these injection site reactions we see, you know, whether or not it will, I guess, remains to be seen. But, you know, in theory, you would think that less frequent doses would help with some of these injection site reactions that people are having. And you know, I obviously we don't know the answer to that, and we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, hopefully that the reduction in the injection volume and the frequency compared to, you know, what we see with Strensiq would definitely be a change and something that would be beneficial from that perspective.
Yes, that's hopefully. Exactly right. Hopefully.
All right. So two more questions. Timing. You know, again, everybody asks, when is this drug going to be approved? You know, we're obviously enrolling in these clinical trials. What do you think is a good timeline? You know, we have some patients who are trying to decide whether to wait. And I always tell them, you know, if you have an opportunity to get on therapy, you know, talk about it with your doctor, because it's probably at least a few years out.
Yeah. So, you know, on average from the beginning of a phase three to FDA approval is about 7 years. So It's, you know, it to conduct a clinical trial takes a lot of time. And so, you know, there's that whole enrollment process of getting patients to enroll in the study. And then, you know, when you're looking at what we call our primary outcomes, if the magnitude of change is small, then that's going to take even longer to show meaningful change, statistically significant change. So it takes a long time. And again, the other thing that I think makes it worth the wait is that the longer you study something in a controlled, safe environment, like a clinical trial, the more you're really going to understand side effects. So I think that's really worth it to take your time. So we're not exposing patients to any undue risk. Now, the one thing that has changed really in favor for rare disease is that the FDA will give what's called breakthrough designation or fast track approval for rare disease, especially if there is no treatment option that's on the market.
Right.
And this is just with the understanding that clinical trials in rare disease are so hard because there are so few patients, and not only so few patients, but these patients are desperate. And, you know, many times these rare diseases, there's, you know, it's very scary or painful or, so the FDA appreciates that sometimes we need to, you know, do things a little bit more expeditiously for in rare disease. And so that's one thing that breakthrough designation can sometimes shorten that time from the initiation of phase three to FDA approval. Now, you know, that being said, we don't have a crystal ball and we don't know what might come up over the next couple of years. I think, you know, a good example was, you know, none of us saw COVID coming, and to run a clinical trial in the middle of a pandemic is incredibly challenging. And so that's something that is going to slow things down. The other thing is if there's any kind of safety issue that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So if the safety issue comes up, then in terms of protecting everybody in the study, you really need to do your due diligence and take a serious look of whether or not this was related to the study or related to the new drug. And so sometimes that can slow things down a little bit too. But at the end of the day, you have to do what's safe, and you have to do what's going to protect patients.
Yeah. If people have questions about whether or not they're eligible, you know, some of the listeners may fit into some of this criteria and may be eligible, where's the best place for them to go for information? Is it to ask their doctor? Is there a website you're aware of? Where should I send them?
I think that clinicaltrials.gov is fantastic. Yeah. So all you do is you just type clinicaltrials.gov into your web browser. And this, this is a site where you can find any clinical trial for any disease. It's really easy to search for it. So go to clinicaltrials.gov, you put in hypophosphatasia, and it's going to show you old studies, new studies, studies that are enrolling. And so not only that, but it's going to tell you, it gives you a very clear synopsis of where the study is taking place. So you can see just geographically if there's a place close to where you live. And then it's, you know, very clearly states what are the, what's the inclusion criteria and what's the exclusion criteria. So you can see if the study is a good fit for you, if you check all the boxes to get enrolled into that. And they'll tell you, you know, what's the primary outcome? What is the study measuring? And so you really know what that is as well. It'll tell you whether or not there's going to be a placebo, and will give you, you know, a timeline. Yeah. And it'll also let you know if the study is enrolling or if it's
capacity or whatever it is.
So I feel like that is a website that's very easy to use and is very clear. And then what it also does is it gives you contact information for each of the individual sites. So if there was a place where you were interested in participating in that study, then you can just go right to that contact information and contact them see if there's a, you know, potential opportunity for you to get enrolled.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, this has been fantastic. I know you're so busy, and I'm so appreciative of your time and you taking part of your day to explain all of this to us. I know it's so many questions that a lot of our patients and families have been asking. So I appreciate it so much.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And, you know, I just think Softbones is an amazing organization. Everything that you do for patients and families is just unbelievable. So again, I'm just very honored to do this podcast with you today. So thank you.
Thanks so much. And that wraps up another episode of Bonafide HPP. Thanks for joining us. And I hope everybody has a happy holiday season.
This has been a production of Bonafide HPP, the official podcast of Soft Bones, the U.S. Hypophosphatasia Foundation. For more information, you can go to www.softbones.org, or to recommend a guest to be featured on Bonafide HPP, email us at info@softbones.org.